If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
This is Intelligence Matters with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell. Brought to you by Palantir Technologies, foundational software of tomorrow, delivered today.
As an analyst, there was this feeling of, I think, a profound anxiety that we were going to get something wrong. And working on Syria, we felt a lot of pressure to write honest and objective analysis, but also to not make mistakes and to give the president and those around him the best possible information. One of the key themes I look at in the book, both from a CIA standpoint, but especially from a Syrian standpoint, is how do people behave in situations where they don't really have a lot of control or agency, in a setting where, you know, you're sort of beholden to these larger forces that seem to be dictating policy or ripping the country apart. It was definitely one of the things I was most interested in exploring in this book.
David McCloskey is the author of the new novel, Damascus Station. David is also a former CIA analyst. I just sat down to talk to David about his novel, his career, and the issue he worked on that led him to write his new book. We'll be right back after a break. I'm Michael Morell, and this is Intelligence Matters.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
David, thanks for joining us. It's great to have you on Intelligence Matters.
Great to be here, Michael. Thank you.
So, David, your book, Damascus Station, a novel, was published a couple of weeks ago. It was released to terrific reviews. David Petraeus, our former boss, former CIA director, said, and I'm going to quote here, "Damascus Station is the best spy novel I have ever read." That's high praise. As you know, that's high praise coming from David. And I'm wondering, when you were working at CIA, did anyone ever tell you, "David, that's the best piece of analysis I've ever read. David, that's the best PDB I've ever read"?
No, it was, I would, you know, there was, you know, praise given to many of the products that I wrote, but it was always a bit more measured than General Petraeus's wonderful comment on my novel. Always a little bit different, I think, in the analytical context as opposed to the world of spy.
Sure. So, David, what's the book about, without giving anything away, of course, and why did you write it?
Yeah, so the book, it is a spy novel. It's set in the early years of the Syrian Civil War, and it is about a CIA case officer named Sam and his Syrian recruit, Mariam, who break one of the cardinal rules and fall into a forbidden relationship. When they go into Damascus to track down the killer of another CIA case officer, they come across a very dark secret at the heart of the Syrian regime. And it's really a book about love, loyalty, betrayal, and what it means to be human in the middle of a very dark war. And I wrote it, Michael, I think for a couple of reasons. I mean, one was I had always wanted to write ever since I was a kid and had never just found the right combination of inspiration and time to sit down and do it. But more specifically to this book, I was really interested. I covered Syria extensively while at CIA. And the kind of work and writing that we do, of course, as you well know, is highly analytical. And when I left, I was really interested in exploring the human aspects of that conflict from a variety of different perspectives and really understanding and processing, I think, in some ways, what it would feel like to live through a conflict like that and the very kind of hard and troubling choices that people would have to make and really to explore the wide range of human emotion and experience that a conflict like that brings out, everything from heroism and bravery all the way to, you know, the sort of tragedy and brutality of the war. So I really wanted to bring that to life through these stories in the book. And then I also wanted, I'm a longtime diehard reader of all kinds of spy thrillers and spy fiction, going back to when I was very young. And after, you know, I'd say about 2 days of working at the CIA, you quickly realize that almost everything you read is nothing like the real work of intelligence.
Right.
And as I spent more time at the agency, I just realized that the actual business of intelligence is highly dramatic. The one example being the relationship between a case officer and their asset. I mean, that is a intimate, deep relationship that allows you to explore all kinds of emotions. And a lot of the work of intelligence is quite dramatic. So I wanted to write a book. I mean, it's fictional and I took some liberties for sure, but I wanted to write a book that brought to life or into the open as much as I could responsibly a bit more of the work of CIA to make that feel real to people.
David, you said you were a fan of spy novels, and I wonder, besides Damascus Station, what's your favorite novel of all time?
Oh, gosh, that is a hard question. I think it is probably Little Drummer Girl by John le Carré, which has recently, there's also a great streaming show based on the book.
And there was a movie too.
And a movie too, exactly. I think that book, the wonderful thing about le Carré is that he's a spy novelist, but not really. He's just a phenomenal novelist and storyteller. But I love that story for the human relationships in there and the sort of plumbing of the depths of a relationship between a case officer and an agent, which I think is fascinating and just so well told by him. That is probably my favorite book.
You know, one of the things that I've always wondered about spy novels and I guess about mysteries too, is when you sit down to write, do you have the arc of the story in your mind? Do you know where you're going? Do you know all the twists and turns? Do you know the secrets that are going to be revealed? How does all that work?
Yeah, so when I sat down to write Damascus Station, I had a short outline and I had an idea of a highly climactic scene that I wanted to occur at the end of the book. And I would say upon, sitting down to actually write the thing, all of that got blown up. And what I discovered, and I think this is different for different writers, but for me personally, what I discovered was that the writing process was something akin to an archaeological dig, where I kind of knew where I wanted to dig, in this case, the CIA and Syria and the war. And I had some idea of the characters, but as I wrote more, I found that they surprised me. And I found that, you know, there were times where I would be digging in a particular part of that site for an extended period of time. And I would realize at the end that, you know, writing my outline wasn't the best story I could tell. And the characters would reveal, as weird and sort of mystical as that sounds, maybe, that the characters would guide the story and would point in the right direction. And so I found that it was helpful to have the outline, but the results in Damascus Station bears almost no resemblance to it. And it was a much more improvisational process as I went along to kind of build the story. There's a great E.L. Doctorow line about writing novels, which is something to the order of, it's like a long car trip in the middle of a storm at night with the headlights on. You know, you don't see much of the road, but you can drive the whole way in that manner. And I think that's what my process was like.
So, David, I would love to jump backwards in time here and have you walk us through your career. You know, what brought you to the CIA? What did you work on?
Yeah. So I was recruited at college. I went to a small liberal arts school in the Midwest that is not typically a school at which CIA recruits. But when I was a sophomore, the gentleman who ran the office, the CIA analytic office, formerly known as NISA, Near East and South Asian Analysis, was a alum of my school. And when he was on a recruiting trip going through the Chicagoland area, he came by and did a talk about the CIA and working in intelligence. And I was a 19-year-old international relations major who, you know, listened to that and thought, it sounded pretty darn cool. So I applied and joined as a undergraduate intern, actually, as a 19-year-old. Mm-hmm. And I did 2 summers and then was an analyst for about 6 years. And during that entire time at the agency, I was focused on Syria and the Middle East and counterterrorism issues. And then, you know, up until that point, you know, I was polygraphed and joined as a 19-year-old. My major experience working in the private sector had been when I was a cashier at Wendy's in high school. And I got to a point where I thought I wanted to see what it was like outside of CIA and DC. And I loved working at the agency. It's a wonderful place, as I hope people who read Damascus Station know that it speaks to them. But I joined a consulting firm after leaving CIA. And I had a few months in between the two jobs. And so I sat down in a coffee shop in DC and just started to write about Syria and the agency. And I put together about 100,000 words in 3 or 4 months in between the two jobs, and then started the consulting work, which, you know, is pretty intense. And so I put the manuscript aside and did a consulting job primarily focused on transportation and logistics and energy companies. So very separate from the work that I'd been doing at the CIA. But I kind of had always had this itch to go back to the writing to see if I could at least finish the book. And so I had an opportunity for a number of reasons to take some time about 2 years ago. To take some time and sort of focus on writing. And I went back to that old manuscript and I looked at it and I reread it and I thought, man, this is terrible. This is really awful. And I put it aside and I thought, you know, if I've got this time, I'm going to be a little bit more structured about writing a book that's fun for me and that also might be fun for others to read. And so I started writing, and the result of that is Damascus Station. I'm now working on another book. It's not Syria focused. It's got a whole different crop of characters and is more focused on imagining the next phase of the U.S.-Russia spy war. But I'm now working on that and writing full time.
So let's just bracket your time at the agency. What year did you start and what year did you leave? I just want to get a sense of the Syria timeline here.
So I started covering it as an intern in 2006. And then I left in the spring of 2014, well into the unrest and the civil war.
And did you work on it from both the political perspective as well as the counterterrorism perspective?
I did, yes. Most of my work was from a political standpoint, but I did some rotations inside CTC that were focused on it from a counterterrorism angle, mostly prior to the conflict, when Syrian CT issues were much more about the foreign fighter networks going into Iraq.
So, David, if it's okay with you, I'd like to dig into your experience a little bit more about working on Syria. And I'm wondering if you can talk about how you, right, not the CIA, but you from an analyst perspective, saw the evolution of events in Syria, you know, how you thought about them at the time, how you think about them today, you know, from sort of the start of the civil war on.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I covered Syria for a long time when it was sort of a sleepy second tier Middle Eastern autocracy, at least from a U.S. policymaker standpoint. So the kinds of, you know, our focus and analysis on it was much more about its foreign policy and its relationships in the region and, you know, the problems it created for us. And when the Arab Spring began, so this would have been late 2010, early 2011.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a decent amount of time in the region in the run-up to that on a number of TDYs. And it was, from a personal standpoint, the beginning of this was extremely exciting. And the region for so long had felt maybe a little bit, and in particular Syria, it had felt a little bit kind of frozen and stale in some respects. And obviously that wasn't really true, but it felt that way as an analyst sometimes. And there was this sense of excitement and promise in the region that I think was pretty infectious. And we talked at the time with some analysts who had covered the fall of the wall and the collapse of communism across Eastern Europe. And you kind of had this sense that you were seeing the tectonic plates of history shifting kind of in real time. And that was really exciting. And being in the Middle East for part of that period, you also could just see it and feel it. I remember watching a lot of the protests in Tahrir Square from another Middle Eastern capital. And I would sort of look around and watch how these people were viewing it. And you just got the sense that 2 months earlier, everyone had felt like this wasn't possible. And now the kind of wall of fear in this country was breaking down. And there was a promise for change and something better, which I think was very, very infectious.
I remember that, yeah.
I would also say at the time, as an analyst, there was this feeling of, I think, a profound anxiety that we were going to get something wrong. And a feeling perhaps that, you know, this, there wasn't any way around this, but a feeling that we had been caught a little bit flat-footed by Tunisia and Egypt. And working on Syria, we felt a lot of pressure to write honest and objective analysis, but also to not, you know, to not make mistakes and to give the president and those around him the best possible information. So there was this kind of, I think, duality of infectious excitement, but also a tremendous amount of responsibility that we felt to make the right calls and to provide the best analysis possible to policymakers early on in the crisis.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. Then we'll be right back with more of our discussion with David.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
So, David, the big inflection points, right? The arrival of the Iranians and Hezbollah, the arrival of the Russians. Talk a little bit about those key inflection points.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, broadly, I think there were a number during the arc of the conflict, and you've pointed a few of the big ones out. I think even going back a little bit further, there was, so the protest movement started in the spring of 2011. And I think that was obviously a large inflection point. The wall of fear, as you know, said, broke down, and people got out onto the streets and protested in ways they hadn't before. For that first year, there was a kind of waffling response by the regime. There were growing protests. There was a sort of bubbling insurgency. And I think in the early part of 2012, there was an inflection point on the regime side where they moved to a kind of scorched earth military campaign.
Right.
That also brought in the Iranians. And from 2012 to 2015, I would say, or somewhere around there, you saw the sort of steady erosion of regime control and the growing kind of militarization and militiaization of the conflict, and a variety of foreign actors pouring in support, the Iranians and Russians doing it in a fairly directive way, and, you know, others, the Saudis, the Qataris, for example, doing it in Turks in a bit more of a haphazard way. I think that a huge inflection point, as you mentioned, was the Russian intervention in 2015, which at that point in time, the Syrian regime controlled, estimates vary, but maybe around 20 to 25% of Syrian territory. So it had been significantly beaten back. And the Russian intervention set in motion a 4 or 5 year period where the Syrian regime clawed back most of the territory. Now, today they only control maybe 70 to 75% of it, but that Russian intervention really turned the tide and brought the regime back from the brink of destruction. I would also argue, just going back maybe a little bit further into 2013, which I neglected to mention, that there was a period of time early on in the crisis where it was possible that we would get a fairly full-throated U.S. military intervention in Syria,
right,
or it was debated.
Right.
And there was a serious inflection point when we very clearly decided not to do that after the chemical attack, the sarin attack in Ghouta, a Damascus suburb, in August of 2013, when the Obama administration effectively decided to punt the decision to Congress, and we did not conduct a punitive or regime damaging strike in response to that. So, you know, I think that there were a number of cases, a number of points in this conflict where things could have decisively gone against the Syrian regime, and that did not pan out.
As you know better than anybody, analysts are trained not to let their policy views affect their analysis, but that doesn't mean that analysts don't have views, right, of what the United States should be doing. And I'm just wondering today, with 2020 hindsight, how you think about the evolution of President Obama's approach to Syria and what we might have done differently, what more risk we might have taken that might have changed the outcome.
Well, this is really the $64,000 counterfactual question on Syria. And it's one that, you know, I think, let me say first off that I don't envy at all the decisions that the Obama administration had to make around Syria. This was happening in a extremely volatile regional context, and it was all happening sort of at a time or around a time when the administration was really trying to extricate itself from heavy involvement in the Middle East, and it found itself sort of drawn back in. That said, I think that when you look at our Syria policy in those early years, there was a tremendous gap between our objectives and the national power that we were willing to commit to achieve
right.
them.
Right.
And anytime that happens, it's just a recipe for confusion on the part of allies and enemies alike, which is counterproductive, and a loss of credibility. And I think that, you know, we said we wanted Assad to go. We made that pronouncement in August of 2011. We said we wanted to support an opposition against him. We really didn't do things to achieve those objectives. And I think that, you know, that gap was always very problematic. Now, when it comes to, you know, the red line and our posture there, I think that, you know, we could have conducted a set of punitive strikes on Assad that would have stopped short of having to depose his regime. And I think it was a real mistake not to do that, especially after we had sort of committed U.S. credibility to, you know, to just to stopping him from using those weapons, or from at least punishing him for doing so. Now, when I think about more broadly, should we have tried to unseat the regime or done more to support the opposition or to destabilize them? I think that I say no. And the reason for that is because if I look just at our track record in Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya, we are adept at breaking things, and we could have no doubt broken Assad. But we have not shown a track record of being able to really build cohesive, stable, fairly representative governing entities back from the rubble of what we destroy. And I think in Syria, to believe that it would have been different, you would have to think that there was a set of local partners who would have been able to come alongside us in that effort. And when we looked at the opposition in those early years, the most credible actors on the ground were unfortunately Salafi jihadist groups that were well-organized and well-trained and well-funded. And the opposition that we would have found more, you know, amenable to U.S. interests was fragmented and weak, and would not have been able to carry water on the ground for us in a fight against Assad. So I think we would have ended up with a situation where, you know, you break it, you buy it, and we would have owned it. And I don't think that the dynamics today with us owning it would necessarily be better for U.S. interests. And so I think we were right not to depose Assad, but wrong not to respond to the use of chemical weapons and to frankly be more punitive with him or create some kind of strategic deterrence for the use of those weapons.
Yeah, on your first point, I think that's exactly where President Obama came out personally and why he made the decision he made not to intervene much more significantly. But, you know, to your earlier point, that says to me that we should never have announced that our policy was to get rid of Assad, right? Because that set in train a bunch of expectations on the ground that we were not able to support or not willing to support at the end of the day.
I think that's exactly right. And if I go back to that time period and really think about how the administration was looking at the region and looking at Syria, I think that the original sin of our policy and something that really drove, as I said, that gap between objectives and where we were willing to commit resources was this sense of inevitability to his demise. And when you looked at the region at the time, you know, Ben Ali had fled in January, Mubarak stepped down in February, I believe, of 2011. There were massive protests in Yemen, in Bahrain, I think in eastern Saudi. There were Libya had broken out. And so there was this sense, I think, of these dominoes are falling and Assad's going to be gone at some point. So we can kind of say the right things without having to do much to affect the outcome. And over time, it, you know, became clear that, well, the regime actually had a significant amount of resources to use to keep itself in power. It had the willingness to use them. And, you know, that gap widened as we continued to say the same things rhetorically without backing them up.
We're going to take another quick break. We'll be right back with more Intelligence Matters. Stay with us.
We all have busy lives these days, and we don't want to waste a day recovering after a night out. That's why ZBiotics is the answer we've all been looking for. Their probiotic was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. This is a proactive solution that wards off feeling miserable the next day instead of a reactive approach like drinking electrolytes or eating greasy food. Enhance your mornings with ZBiotics. Go to ZBiotics.com/CBS to get 15% off your first order when you use code CBS at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/CBS and use the code CBS at checkout for 15% off. Thank you, ZBiotics, for sponsoring this episode and our good times.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
So David, when I read the book, you're right, there's a strong sense of loyalty and betrayal in the book. I won't say any more than that. And when I was reading it, I was wondering to what extent you were thinking about how the opposition might have felt about the United States at that time. Is there any truth to that?
Well, I would certainly be lying if I said that the experiences, in particular working on the war, didn't dramatically and sort of greatly inform the writing of this book. And I think I try to capture in a couple points, without giving too much away, the sense that we made a lot of promises to many different people in the region. I think this is what I was really interested in dealing with in the book, was that, you know, there's a policy discussion we could have about the U.S. keeping its word and its credibility, but there were also promises made to individuals who were standing up to a government that they hated and sought to bring down. And I wish that we hadn't said some of those things. And I wanted to deal authentically in the book with, you know, how those relationships, the human-to-human relationships sort of pan out in a world where there's also high-level kind of statecraft and policy decisions happening above them that they don't really control. And so I think one of the key themes I look at in the book, both from a CIA standpoint, but especially from a Syrian standpoint, is how do people behave in situations where they don't really have a lot of control or agency? And how do they protect people they love and their family? And how do they love others in a setting where, you know, you're sort of beholden to these larger forces that seem to be dictating policy or ripping the country apart? It was definitely one of the things I was most interested in exploring in this book.
Do you still follow events in Syria? Do you still pay attention to them?
I do. I had to go through a period of detox after I left because it had become upsetting and hard to watch. And, you know, it wasn't what I was focused on really at all in my consulting work. And so I took a little bit of a break. But in particular, as I was writing the book starting a few years ago, I, uh, I started to dive back into it and follow it. And, you know, the book is dedicated first to my wife, but secondly to the people of Syria. I feel a very strong emotional connection to them and to the conflict, and I'm hopeful that in some way, you know, there will be a future better than the past as I write the book.
What do you think the future portends, and why does it matter to the United States?
I think, you know, from a geostrategic standpoint, not a human standpoint, but a geostrategic one, I often do have to remind myself, and I think we as analysts had to remind ourselves, that, you know, Syria is a relatively small country that doesn't move global energy markets, that, you know, thankfully does not have a nuclear weapon, and with which we have very few economic relations or cultural relations whatsoever. So Syria is a small place from a geostrategic standpoint. And I think that, you know, from a policy standpoint, it's just important to think about that when we talk about the U.S. response. But when we look at the conflict today and sort of where it's headed, I think that, you know, civil wars either end through political settlement or through military victory for one party. And it seems clear to me today that a political settlement is not in the cards. All the parties on the ground have wildly divergent interests, and the UN brokered process in Geneva has gone nowhere and seems to be going nowhere. From a military standpoint, you know, the country is effectively divided into four or so zones of influence. The Syrian regime controls most of the territory, but not most of the natural resources. And there's parts of the country that are occupied by us and our allies, and by the Turks and their allies, and a canton that the rebels still hold. So it's the idea or concept of a unified Syria at this point in time is just that. It's a concept. But I think we're at a point where, you know, no one can really win, and also no one thinks that they can fully lose. And so we're at a kind of a stalemate in the conflict today. And I think there's a tendency, because we look at Syria as if it's, you know, a real country that, of course, its natural state is to be unified and put back together, that we think, oh, well, the war has to end at some point. And I remember we looked actually during the early days of the conflict at some of the political science research on civil wars. And, you know, the average duration of one is 10 years. We've hit that in Syria. But they go on for much longer when you have a bunch of different factions on the ground and when you have foreign parties involved. And the Lebanese civil war lasted for 15 years. You could argue that Afghanistan was in civil war for much of the 80s through today, and Sri Lanka lasted for about 25 years, I think. So there's no real reason why the conflict needs to end anytime soon. And I think we're at a point where the lines in control are fairly well drawn for now, and where many of the different parties can get what they want by just sitting tight. So I think, unfortunately, we're sort of headed for more of the same in Syria, barring, you know, some kind of unforeseen event.
David, let me come back to the book. I want to ask you how the CIA pre-publication review process went for you.
Well, the headline here is it went very well. I have found the PRB to be extremely responsive to, you know, I think they read the book. Honestly, Michael, I think they got through it in like 3 days. Well, I like to think that because the person reviewing it had so much fun, but they're also just very efficient. And they, you know, I also was, I think, smart about what I chose to include and not include, and had a sense of what would be, you know, responsible versus irresponsible. And so I tried to, you know, not include things that would be irresponsible and that they would have objection to. They made a few changes to, not to storylines or anything really big like that, but they edited out some detail that I think was appropriate. And my favorite part of the PRB process is that they will return a PDF that has the blacked out highlighter on it.
Yeah, which I remember that.
It's got kind of a vintage Cold War vibe to it that I appreciate. But I have found working with the PRB to be, you know, they're pros at this. They're efficient, and I didn't have any issues with Damascus Station.
Well, David, good luck with this book. I think it's going to do extraordinarily well. I encourage my listeners to read the book, and good luck in writing your next book. Thank you for joining us. The book is Damascus Station. The author is David McCloskey. David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Michael. Great to be with you.
That was David McCloskey. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is sponsored by Palantir Technologies, foundational software of tomorrow, delivered today. The show is produced by Olivia Gassis, Jamie Benson, Paulina Smolinski, and Ashley Armstrong. For more from this week's show, visit cbsnews.com. Intelligence Matters is a production of CBS News.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Intelligence Matters ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.